couldn't get it out of my mind. I had to get hold of a psychologist. I was just like, this can't go on.
Jamie Carragher is a Liverpool stalwart. 730 odd appearances.
There's never going to be another Jamie Carragher.
He's a winner.
Urge to shoot. He will, you know.
Oh! That's just ridiculous. I'm no huge Ronaldo fan. I think that's pretty obvious. It's sad for him, the way people are speaking about Messi towards the end of his career and Ronaldo, and it's completely different. It's almost like he feels like he's not rated even. I've got so much admiration for him for his mental strength. To be able to withstand pressure, criticism, and I saw too many players never recover from that. I knew from the first time I played football, for me, winning was all that mattered. If you say to me, what do I miss most about being a professional footballer? It's winning. I'd rather cheat and win than not win.
When Jamie loses a game, is he different?
I punish myself when I didn't perform well, and I regret that, but there was always that thing of, am I good enough? I was just driving myself mad. When I was at my absolute peak and best, that's when I needed more help. The feeling in your stomach is that bad. You're gonna be there. I always remember, and the only time I've ever did this in my whole career.
Much of your success has been a result of a winning mentality in some of the toughest moments. Where does that come from?
The reason why I've become the player I have, I think it's...
Quick one before this episode starts. About 75% of people that listen to this podcast on audio platforms, Spotify and Apple, haven't yet hit the follow button. If I could ask a favour from you, if you've ever enjoyed this podcast, please could you just go and hit that follow button on your app? It helps this show more than I could possibly say. And the bigger the show gets, the better the guests get. Thank you and enjoy this conversation. Jamie. When I start this podcast, I usually start with people's childhoods. But as I was reading through your story, I think this is the first time I'm going to start before the person was even born. Because I read that there was a possibility that you weren't even going to be born because of a misdiagnosis that your mother was given about you. Can you take me back to that story?
Yeah, that was... Would have been about 1977, obviously. 78, I was born. And my mum has had two miscarriages before me. And then when I, she fell pregnant with me, the doctors, nurses didn't know what was wrong, but they knew something was wrong. And initially they were saying, we think your child has got spina bifida. And I think... Well, I'm saying it in those days, maybe, I don't know if it's the same now, there's a chance you could terminate the pregnancy if the baby was whatever, you know. And my mum was, I think, was given that option. And my mum's very holy, I think's the right word. Probably at that stage, in her early 20s, she would be going to church every day. She still goes every Sunday now. So for her thing was, no, if the word she says to me was, if our Lord wants me to have a baby who's got spina bifida or maybe something else, that's what's being decided for me. That's fine. It's my child. I love that child. And what I find fascinating when you think of sort of today is that the closer it got to me being born, it wasn't spina bifida, but they still knew something wasn't right. And it wasn't until I was born that I had basically, my insides were on the outside. So I've gastroschisis, it's called, the condition. Now I've got a big scar right across my stomach. I mean, if someone has that condition today, and plenty of babies do, it's a really small scar. But the thing that I think is fascinating, or just makes me think, wow, on my mum's side, is the fact that as soon as I was born, I was rushed away, straight away to Alderhay Children's Hospital, which is still going strong today in Liverpool. And because of what I've gone to achieve, I've got a real link with the hospital. And through our charity, we actually funded the ward that looks after babies who have what I had. But I get rushed away to Children's Hospital and my mum doesn't know anything. There's no phones, she's still in Vazakli Hospital obviously I've got a problem straight up to Alder Hey. My dad goes straight there. But again, there's the technology isn't like that. And I just think, how long must there have been before, one, my mum knew I was all right, what I had, how quickly did I have to go? You know, you can't quite fathom that when you think about today and how quickly we can get in touch with different people. So I just think about what was going through my mum's mind there for that sort of the next hour or two until, you know, she probably found out everything was okay.
Your knowledge of that story and that experience, has that left a lasting impact or impression on you in terms of the decision your mum made or being whisked away or the operation or having the scar or anything like that? Has that left any sort of impression on you at all?
Yes. All about my mum, I would say. You know, to have had two miscarriages, to have that going through your third pregnancy, to think you could lose the baby, no one can quite give you a definitive answer about what's going on with, you know, this child in your stomach. And then to not know straight away. I only know of now and when people have kids, and I've had my own kids, and everything's so documented, isn't it? Whether it's, you know, the first picture, Instagram, you're there with the baby when the baby's born. I wasn't actually, maybe we can get to that later. I wasn't there for my firstborn. And that's something I do regret. But I just think about how my mum must have felt and sort of me looking at my mum, because I've been very lucky, the life I now lead, the experience I've had. You know, it's not there if my mum doesn't make, you know, certain decisions. Not along with my dad, of course, but yeah, for my mum to sort of make that decision. And I'm still here today.
What about your dad? What talk to me about him and his character and what impact that had on you before the age of 10.
He's a real big character. Yeah, he's, you know, he'll be in the pub, he'll have a debate, he'll get up and sing, he'll have an argument with someone. He's like a real larger-than-life sort of character.
Who did you care about impressing the most? Just not even in the context of your parents, but just who were you trying to impress when you were young? Because for me, you know, it might have been my older brothers, it could have been my dad, it could have been, you know, a teacher. Who were you trying to impress?
I mean, the obvious one is to say is my dad, because he was the one who was always there in terms of... Are you talking about football? My mum never watched me play football.
Okay.
I mean, my mum must have watched me play 5 times in my life. And that's nothing to do with not being proud of me or not being there, but I know it's not the done thing now, but it was almost a case of my dad took us to football and my mum stayed at home, you know, and did what we associate with women things. And now, obviously, that type of comment or them thoughts, certainly back then, be classed as like sexist now, and rightly so. But that was just the way it was. It wasn't, I don't think my mum was sort of badgering my dad to go to the football. She always just felt, well, okay, that's your thing to take them to the football, whether to be going to watch Everton as young kids or, you know, play me games for, you know, amateur teams, little boys, and I'm going to start on that journey.
And when he took you to football, did he have high standards and expectations for you when you were playing?
Yes, but I think that came not because he was so desperate for me to be a footballer. I think that became because I think he knew pretty early on I had something. You know, my dad had played football, my dad had watched football. My dad was a massive football fan. So he'd done everything you could do in football in terms of played amateur football, managed amateur teams, went to watch Everton home and away. So he was obsessed with football. So from a young age, I think he was quite tough on me a couple of times that stand out, only because he knew the standards I could get to. And one of those times is like a story I put in my book. And I think sometimes when my dad listens back, I think he doesn't like me to say the story, because I think he looks back at it and thinks, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. But I've got no problem with it. You know, I think it's part of my life, part of my story, that basically I was 7 years of age and I didn't want to play in a game. It was that cold, it was freezing, it was hailstone, and I got tackled and I pretended I was here crying and come off. But my dad and I'm the same, we couldn't suffer bluffers or phonies, we'd say, you know, that type of thing. And he knew I was putting it on. And let's just say it was the last time I did.
Well, I read that part in your memoir.
Yeah.
in your memoir, it says there was some raining football boots when you got home.
Yeah, maybe there's a little bit of artistic license there with the guy who wrote it. But no, I think it was that. And I think throughout my football career, I'm not talking about feigning injury, I'm talking about the big thing for me, and the big thing for me that I want to pass on to my son is having character. That for me will take you to places that you don't think are possible. If you've got that personality, mental strength, character, I think that overrides a lot of things.
That's really why I'm asking these questions, because I could see throughout your career that much of your success has been a result of a winning mentality and character in some of the toughest moments. And that's not the case with all the footballers that I've spoken to. That's just the case with some of them. And even when I sat with Peter Crouch, he referenced you as being so set on winning and so obsessed with winning that he didn't think you were ever enjoying it. And so I'm trying to figure out, and you smile when I say that because you know it's true. I've heard you say that subsequently, but where does that come from? Where does that character and that obsession with victory at all costs, to the point that you cause suffering in yourself, where does that come from?
I think my dad, and whether you're born with something like that, maybe you know, you speak to a lot of probably more people who could give you that answer than I do, and maybe have a better insight into it to me in some ways. And that I'm not quite sure, but I knew from the first time I played football, for me, winning was all that mattered. And if you say to me, what do I miss most about being a professional footballer? It's winning. It's not the taking part, it's not the training. A lot of people always say this. I hear footballers say this all the time. I miss the dressing room. I don't miss the dressing room. I miss the dressing room after the game when we win. That, like, oh, you've done something together. And I listened to Crouchy's podcast because I've seen it pop up somewhere. I think it was made online or something. Peter Crouch said, Stephen Gerrard and Jamie Carragher writ off players after 15 minutes. I thought, I better listen to this one. But what Peter Crouch said is right. And he's probably looking at me a little bit dumbfounded. I can't understand that. But I can't understand him. Bill Shankly said, football is a matter of life and death. And I don't think he meant that. I think that was obviously tongue-in-cheek at the time. And no football club knows that statement is not true more than Liverpool Football Club. But it's very close to being true. That's the way I see it. Football for me is a way of life, and winning is all that matters. And for me, when I played, I'd rather cheat and win than not win. And I don't think I'll ever be any different. And that's why I think football has taken me to places in my life that almost brings a tear to my eye. But it's always taken me to places where I'm like, I don't feel like I'm ever going to get over it. You know, a result or something hasn't gone well.
You mentioned that post-match feeling is the best and potentially the feeling you miss. But I've also heard you describe it as relief.
Mm.
You know, and that's an interesting thing, because people would think the post-match victory feeling would be euphoria and elation, but for you to describe it as relief is a curious word.
Because I knew how bad I'd feel if we didn't win or it hadn't gone well. It was almost relief that I'm not going to feel like that for the next 2 or 3 days, because I think I punished myself a little bit when I didn't perform well or we didn't win, and I regret that, but I don't know if I could have done anything different. It was me. You know, I spoke to a site. At one stage, I spoke to us. I had to get hold of a psychologist, sports psychologist who I knew, because what I was doing to myself was, I was just driving myself mad, really, with the standards I was expecting of myself. And this, I must say, was not when I was not playing well and short of confidence. This was when I was at my absolute peak and best. That's when I needed more help. Because I got to a stage where I felt I couldn't make a mistake. If I didn't play well, I thought we were going to lose. Yeah, because I wasn't daft. I was playing at my best. I was a huge part of the team. And there was sort of me at the back and Stevie Gerrard at the front, if you like. And there was lots of other great players around there, of course. But I knew I was a huge influence in the Rafa Benitez era. And I felt I'd go into big games thinking, if I don't play well today, we're not going to win. And if I made a mistake, and I always remember the mistake I made, it was away at Atletico Madrid. Champions League group game, we're winning 1-0, we're under pressure constantly, and I'm playing really well. I'm in control. That was me and my element away from home in Europe for Liverpool, trying to get that clean sheet, organising, talking to everyone. And a long ball, and I just misjudged it, and they scored. And in the airport on the way home, I was just like, this can't go on. This has got to stop. You know, that what I'm actually doing to myself, I've played great, I've made a little mistake, you know, they've capitalised on it. But you can't put yourself through that.
What was the symptoms that you were confronting in that moment? Why? What couldn't carry on? So you'd made that mistake, you're in the airport, you're on the plane, whatever. What's happening?
I couldn't get it out of my mind. I couldn't. I'd go like two nights without sleeping. I mean, when I say not sleeping, I might get a couple of hours. I'd be like constantly on my mind. I'd wake up, it'd be the first thing I think about. And I was just like, what am I doing to myself? But how would you stop it? But the fascinating thing was, when I spoke to the sports psychologist, a guy called Bill Beswick, and I knew him from the England squad. After speaking to him, and then it got to the stage where I spoke to him probably two or three times a season, almost like I'd reflect and, you know, what's gone on. I couldn't change. We actually got to the bottom of, actually, this is what's making you who you are. This is the drive to sort of, if you did probably dismiss mistakes and were not too bothered, or I'll be fine next week, that wouldn't make you who you are. And I could still never shake it off. I couldn't, but I almost, by speaking to him, it made me understand and accept that's what it was. So I still went through turmoil if I didn't play well, if I made a mistake. I always wonder if that was like a byproduct of being a local player. I always think, what would I have been like if I had played for Aston Villa or Tottenham? Or, you know, I didn't know that many people. You know, it felt like you were playing for the club or the supporters or your family and friends, really. You know,
did you ever feel anxiety in those moments, the feeling of anxiety? So when something is plaguing you so much that you almost feel that kind of sense of nervous energy that keeps you up at night and you feel it in your stomach?
No, it was never anxiety. I would say anger, and I want to put this right. It's like, I didn't even want to sleep. I want to get to training the next day.
Did that come out in your home life? Because it's hard not to take that home with you.
Yeah, I think it will have done. Yeah. Yeah, 100%. I remember something came up a year or two ago on Twitter about a group of players or a certain player, or may have been a manager, went out and had a meal or a few drinks after they'd lost. And there was this big debate on Twitter. Well, why shouldn't they, you know, some fan, you know what fans are like, they shouldn't go out. And there was this few big debate, and I think Gary Lineker mentioned something that I've never changed my plans on the back of results. Okay, that sounds nice. I thought that was unbelievable. I would change plans every single week if that game didn't go well. So that's where it would have affected my home life. So in terms of organising a night out, going for a meal with friends, whatever it may be, I couldn't have shown my face if we'd have lost and I played poorly. Not a chance. And I couldn't believe that some players could just carry on with their life. I'd be a bit like, oh no. Because the feeling in your stomach is that bad. You don't want to be there. You don't want to be with people. You don't want to speak. You know, that's how much it got me. And I go back to that. You know, would it have been different at another club? I would never have wanted to play for another club. But that is the one thing I do think about. Would it have results and performances affected me differently?
You come home after, you know, losing a game or something, you got your family there, your kids run up. Hey!
I mean, to be fair, my kids were quite young when I was still playing. But there was one game that stands out when I couldn't get out of something. I was opening a restaurant. I opened a restaurant about 10 or 15 years ago called Cafe Sports England in Liverpool. And the two times we opened, those two games I didn't play well. And in my head before the game, I'm thinking, I've got to play well in this game because people will think, if I don't play well, I've got my mind somewhere else. And I was probably too focused on the game in some ways. And then I had to go and almost opened the restaurant, and there was people there. And I remember the second one, it was like, no. I went, I was there 20 minutes. I was like, I've got to go.
If I spoke to Nicola, which I might have done, but I won't tell you before this, I asked the question. And I said, when Jamie loses a game, is he different? And what's he like? What would she have said to me?
100%, yeah. 100%.
What would she have said, do you reckon?
He's not there when I'm talking to him. I think she'd probably say that. Maybe now at different times, but I would be in a trance. I'd just be sort of daydreaming, so people would be speaking to me. And it's probably best just to leave me alone and not try and get my mind off it, because I couldn't. Even if I did get my mind off it, I know I'd go back to it. And you're talking about going home. I always remember one time where I said I was in a trance, where I was with the players. So I always remember we were playing a game against Everton, which for me is the biggest game. I had a nightmare in the game, and we were going for a meal afterwards with the team, like an official, not a sort of few drinks. It was to refuel, basically. This game was an early morning kickoff. We had a Champions League game on the Tuesday night in Eindhoven. We got beat 3-0 at Goodison, and we've gone to the centre of Liverpool for a meal just to make sure we're eating the right food. And I remember just staring, just couldn't stop. I wasn't even eating, just staring. And next thing I get a text message, Stevie Gerrard. He's just like, he's there. He's going, don't worry about it. It's gone, finished. Forget about, just you've got to try and But I was just like, he could just see, everyone was devastated. But for me, I'm not trying to make out that I cared more than anybody else, because everyone's got their own ways of dealing with things. But it's a huge part of my life, football. It always has been, always will be. I think I'll always be affected by football results. That's when I was playing. As an Everton fan, as a Liverpool fan right now, football results will affect me.
It sounds painful. It sounds like suffering. Does it sound like fun?
Well, when you win, I can assure you, I make sure I enjoy them. I know afterwards I said before that it was relief, but you had that moment of sort of joy. The reason it was difficult to enjoy, and why I'm probably different to a Peter Crouch or certain players who came in, is that I think they'd come in from clubs where they played once a week, and if they played well, it was like, I don't need to worry to that game. I'm going to be off for 2 or 3 days, whereas we'd have a game Tuesday, Champions League or a cup game. And then it'd be right, enjoy that. Right, bang, we're back on it now. It was almost like, you're just on this train and nothing's getting in the way, nothing's stopping. But I can assure you, it wasn't all doom and gloom. I loved it, and so many nights and times and experiences. But I do wish I was a little bit kinder to myself on the back of a poor performance or a defeat. I mean, I keep thinking about one standing out. We won the FA Cup final in 2006. Personally, I'd had a great season. We kept 33 clean sheets, which was one away from a record, which was obviously a lot. We played the cup final, I scored an own goal. I didn't play well. Stevie Gerrard wins the final. And we go on the open bus tour around Liverpool. So I've had a great season, but not had a great last game. And my son's on the bus with me. And I go on the top of the bus to start with. But you're on the bus for maybe 3 or 4 hours. Within an hour, I was downstairs. I was just sat there thinking, oh, it didn't go well. I didn't do that. And I was thinking, now when I look at it, I'm embarrassed. I'm like, what are you doing? It was one game. You've had an unbelievable season. The team have. We won the FA Cup. We finished the season with a trophy. But I couldn't. It was almost like I was up there acting, because I didn't feel like celebrating. But we won the cup. And just because I'd made a mistake, hadn't played particularly well. I know most players will be able to go, I've had a great season. It was only one game. We won. I found it tough.
People that have that winner's mindset, they... As you kind of alluded to a second ago, they often struggle to understand those that don't, to relate to them. And they often have a lot of friction with the people that don't have the winner's mindset, because when you see the world in that way, I saw it a lot in Michael Jordan's documentary, Last Dance.
It was brilliant, wasn't it? Yeah.
Amazing. I think I got a poster upstairs after I watched it. But he had that mindset where he was, you could see he would like pick on certain people who wouldn't meet him at his level. Did you ever find yourself and Stevie doing that, where if someone came into the dressing room and they weren't at that level, you'd either force them out, or you'd, I mean, that's kind of what Peter Crouch was alluding to, right? That he was kind of saying that you two would be protecting the bar.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happens is, I think what Peter was trying to mention, which I think was a little bit unfair the way he described it, was that when a new player came in, I think me and Steve were fans. We weren't just players, we were fans. It was like, oh God, I hope he's good. You know, like a fan would, I hope this new fella's good.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you come in after the first training session, it'd be more than a joke. Oh God, this doesn't look good, does it? Or you know what I mean? That type of thing of like, oh God, I hope this goes well. But I was, Stevie was different to me, and I was very vocal, very emotional. Stevie's maybe body language on the pitch at times would be questioned. If, you know, he wasn't happy with somebody, he might turn away, you know, whereas I'd be remonstrating, screaming, shouting, you know, and not in terms of someone hadn't played poorly, but might have been more in terms of organisation, someone doing the job for the team. Where are you? Where you need to be? I always felt like I was the coach of the team in some ways, and because I played at centre back and I could, you know, see the whole team in front of me. Yeah, but we would be on top of people, but I wouldn't like that to come across in like a bullying way, or we were trying to, you know, keep people down here. We loved Torres, Alonso, come. We loved being around great players because you wanted to win. That was all that mattered. It wasn't about securing your place or making sure I was protected in any way. It was that thing of like, it's Liverpool. The big clubs, it's not enough to play for them. And I know some people think, I played for this club and it's on your CV and it's a great achievement to get to a Liverpool, a United, Chelsea, City. But it's not enough to play for, and you've got to win. The whole existence of those clubs is about winning. If they're not winning, there's no point. You know, so that was my thing. My drive at Liverpool was to win every single day.
When Gerard Houllier came in as a manager, we'll just call him Gerard Houllier. When he arrived at Liverpool in, I think it was 1998, he came into the club. The players took to him at first, that I read, because one of the key decisions he made was around Paul Ince.
Mm. Players took to him?
Yeah.
No, I think he found it difficult to start with.
Oh, really?
I think there was a big split in the camp, in that the players who'd come before that with Roy Evans and Gerard Houllier came in, he was new to it. And yeah, I think it was tough for him in that first season. Yeah.
Did that turn at some point? Did he win the trust of the players?
Yeah. I mean, he put Paul Ince, a great fella. I get on great with Paul Ince. Great player as well. Didn't have the career at Liverpool he's had maybe at other clubs. And I think Gerard Houllier just wanted to make a fresh start, and he wanted to, I think most, a lot of managers do it, the take on, you know, the big guy, if you like. And he was certainly that. I think he was maybe England's captain or vice captain at the time. But he wanted to completely revolutionise Liverpool and completely change it. And yeah, he had words with Paul Ince. And the thing was not about him having words as such, but also the fact that he didn't sort of back down. He really held his own. He had a strong argument in the team meeting. And you think, wow, he just stood up to probably one of the best midfield players of his generation.
What was that strong argument in the team meeting?
It was over Paulin's question, what we're doing in training, as senior pros do at times. You know, we're trying to get it right. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing that? And I think Gerard Houllier saw it as his opportunity to sort of stamp his authority. It was almost like, I would imagine, he was glad Paul Ince had said it, and it was Paul Ince in some ways. And I don't think the message was for Paul Ince, because I think he was always going to get rid of Ince. I think the message was to the rest of us, you know, don't try and take me on. This is what we're going to do.
Publicly in front of, in the team meeting,
yeah,
told Paul.
Yeah, basically, no, you wouldn't be at this club anymore, but he questioned his desire in a game. And to be fair, Paul Ince was probably one of the bravest footballers you'd see. But in a particular game against Manchester United, we'd lost it 2-1 and we'd lost two goals in the last minute. And I think it was a very sore defeat for everyone. So I think everyone was a little bit emotional about it. And because Ince had jumped up and said something, he just went straight back and said he wasn't happy that he'd come off. He shouldn't have come off. My captain should come off on a stretcher from Old Trafford. And it was interesting with Gerard Houllier in that we had him the first foreign manager, and all of a sudden people would associate him with this flair football and being maybe a bit nice, but that was what the Liverpool team was before Gerard Houllier came. He completely went the other way and wanted big, strong, powerful players, aggression. And that's why me and him had such a great relationship, because I was such a competitor. Maybe didn't have the quality that some of the players had in the Roy Evans team, if you like, and some of the football they played was outstanding. But he just wanted people who would die for that shirt.
Because I read that part of the reason why his reign as manager sort of came to an end was because he made some bad signings, and he didn't really inquire enough about the players that he was signing's character and their personality. And I was just so compelled by that idea that that's one of the most important things when you're building teams, is finding people that have the same like mentality and character versus just great sort of technical players. I think about the same in business. Like, I'm always considering how someone will support our culture, make our culture better, raise the bar in terms of like that mentality versus just being able to do fucking 1,000 kick-ups or whatever. Loads of skills.
Yeah, I think you do need a certain mentality to play for Liverpool.
What is that mentality?
And the other big clubs. To be able to withstand pressure, criticism that comes your way. So often I saw a lot of Liverpool players who would start really well, and it wouldn't make me think we've got a great player here. I'd always think, let's say a couple of months down the line, because I knew what was coming. Because every player goes through a few bad games, he gets criticism, whatever it may be. And I saw too many players never recover from that. And that tells me that for me, the top level football is mentality. Do you have that personality, character to get you through those tough moments and come back and fight back and not give in?
Can you teach that?
I don't know. You tell me. What do you think?
I tend to believe that it comes from experience. I think resilience and that sort of character, those character traits come from being knocked down loads of times. So when the 10th failure or knockdown comes, or the 10th moment of hardship comes, you're more equipped to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So players that haven't been through the tougher, you know, challenges in their life, maybe in their personal life, maybe where they come from, don't have that.
Well, it's interesting. We're doing this this afternoon, and this morning my son went in for a knee operation.
Your son did?
Yeah.
Right.
So he's going in for a knee operation. He's a professional footballer. And apparently I haven't been able to probably sleep about it, thinking about it, you know, you just want to do as much as you can, you know, to help them, because it's your son. But the thing I keep drumming home to him, and I keep saying it almost every day, we're not using this as an excuse. This is not getting in the way. It's like, this has happened, is it? Okay, bump, we're going again. It's like, this I know for a lot of people, or players, or young players, or whatever it may be, would be a hurdle to come across, and understandably so. But it's not in years to come going to be, oh, I didn't quite do what I wanted because of that knee op. Yeah, and this never happened, and that. It's like, no. There's going to be lots of things in his career, as in my career, obstacles in the way, you've got to get over them. You've got to get them out of the way, or you've got to deal with it and then keep going. Nothing's, and that was always my mindset, and that's what I'm trying to put into my son. I'm pretty confident he's got that mindset of nothing stops you, nothing gets in your way. You don't use anything as an excuse or a reason why something didn't happen. That no excuse mentality, you keep going. No obstacles in the way.
You said earlier on that you might not have cared as much as you did. You might not have had that same level of sort of excruciating obsession and care about the results and the outcome and winning if you'd been at another club. And you were at another club, which is England. Mm. And you didn't seem to care as much. You said that, yeah, in your memoir. I was quite shocked to read that. I remember the text message that said, fuck it, it's only England. And generally, you didn't seem to be as excruciatingly hard on yourself after losing for England as you did with losing for Liverpool.
I think that was down to the fact that I didn't carry the same responsibility, because I never really played. I was like a squad player, mm-hmm, really. I wouldn't class myself as patriotic. Not at all. I don't know what the, I don't know. Can you be patriotic of your own city? Is that a word, or is there something?
I have no idea.
I'm massively passionate about my own city. Maybe that comes from the way we're brought up in Liverpool. You know, the thing of you feel as if like a lot of the country's against you, and maybe that's, some of it's true. Some people outside Liverpool think, oh, that's a chip on your shoulder. But there is that sort of, we sort of buy into that. And that doesn't mean like I'm against England as such, but it watching England now in the World Cup would never take me to a place emotionally the way it would if I saw Liverpool playing. It just wouldn't take me there. It's not like a conscious thing of, oh, I'm not going to be happy about this. It's just inside me. And that wasn't just when I was playing for England. That was when I was a child. I'd be thinking, why aren't England picking the Everton players? You know, it almost felt like England was a team from down south or a London team.
Mm.
That's just the feeling I had. But I think if I would have become a mainstay of the England team, I think I would have felt that. I think I would have got there. And that's me one disappointment in my football career. It's the only team in my life from when I started at 5 years of age, I didn't dominate. And when I say dominate, was be a mainstay of the team, be one of the voices of the team, be one of the leaders, because I wasn't good enough. That's a simple fact.
There's lots of players that you've encountered in your career that didn't reach their potential. You're talking about reaching your potential, doing your best, getting to the top of your potential a second ago. When you think about why those players didn't reach their potential, if you had to point out characteristics or behaviours that led them to miss their potential, what would those behaviours be? The traits of losers.
I think blaming other people at different times for their own poor games, mistakes, always looking for excuses, I would say. I think I'm pretty honest, and I was as a player, and I always remember when I was a young lad, I had a bad game. I keep talking about my bad games, don't I?
Yeah. Like
you remember them more.
Yeah.
But a very famous coach who was a huge inspiration to me was Ronnie Moran. And I played a game and played poorly. And I did an interview after the game saying it was my fault. Those goals were my fault. And even though this was a coach who was a real sort of man's man, a legend of Liverpool Football Club, he wasn't the coach then. He still used to come in and walk around the training ground. And he said, don't ever do that again. He said, you don't need to open yourself up like that. He said, be honest with the dressing room and to your manager. But he said, you know what I mean? Sometimes you've got to be clever and look after yourself a little bit, and you don't need to be as honest. You think you're doing the right thing. And I think I knew exactly where he was coming from. And I think at times you need to be honest, but I think probably other times like that, you maybe need to protect yourself a little bit, but you never hide behind the fact that it was someone else's fault. And again, I keep going back to my son, because I'm not a coach or a manager. And people say to me, you know, could you give something back? But I just want to give it back to my son. And things like that, don't question the manager. Don't make excuses. Don't blame the manager. Or if you come in and say, oh, the coach or the trainer, well, get something out of it. Don't be in the dressing room saying, oh, this isn't good or that isn't good.
Quick word from one of our sponsors. I've got a tip for all of you that will make your virtual meeting experiences, I think, 10 times better. As some of you may know by now, BlueJeans by Verizon offers seamless, high-quality video conferencing. But the reason why I use BlueJeans versus other video conferencing tools is because of immersion. Their tools make you feel more connected to the employees or customers you're trying to engage with. And now, they're launching one of their biggest feature enhancements to impact virtual events so far, called BlueJeans Studio. I actually used it the other day. I did a virtual event using the studio, which I think about 700 of you came to. TV-level production quality, all done by one person with very little technical experience on a laptop. So if you've got an event coming up and you're thinking about doing it virtually, check out BlueJeans Studio now. Let me know what you think, because I genuinely believe, I know this is an advert and I'm supposed to say this, but I genuinely believe it's the best tool I've seen for doing really immersive, simple but high quality production virtual events. Quick one from our longest standing sponsor, Huel. I can't tell you over the last, I'd say over the last, really it's been about 2.5 years. It was really post-pandemic, how much my health has become such a huge priority in my life. And I have this laser focused on what I'm putting into my body. It's funny because as you get older, you can start to feel the things you're putting into your body more and more and more. And if I put something into my body, especially things like gluten, if I put those things in my body, I feel them tremendously the next day, my energy levels, my sleep and everything in between. Huel has been probably the most important partner in my health journey because I've been in the boardrooms, I've been to their offices tens and tens and tens and tens of times. I've seen how they make their decisions on nutrition and I trust it. Most of my team that are in this room with me consume it and get the benefits of it too. So if you haven't already tried Huel, do so. On the point of questioning the manager, one of the things I read was that Gerard Houllier, I can't say his bloody name.
Houllier,
cool. One of the reasons why he ultimately ended up leaving the club was because he started to lose his authority in the dressing room. Now, Peter Crouch said to me that great managers, even when they don't know the right answers, pretend they do. Because they know that if they ever get to a point where the players know that they're not in control, then the authority's gone. And there was a story I read about Gerard Houllier, picking a team and then going and asking Gerard if it was the correct team. And then Gerard said it's not the correct team and changed it. This happened in spring in 2004 in the run-up to a Premier League match away to Manchester United. Gerard Houllier picked the team but then consulted with Gerard whether the selection was right, who said it wasn't right, and then Houllier changed it.
I don't... It rings a bell. I don't know the specific game, if that was the right game, but I think towards the end of his time, I think the results aren't going well. And managers, no matter who they are, they will lose confidence. And Stevie at that time was obviously a megastar, and you're trying to maybe keep people on side, if you like. Not that I think the players were ever offside with Gerard Houllier, but that confidence and belief in the manager starts to ebb away when results don't go well. I wouldn't say Gerard Houllier ever lost the dressing room in terms of how we felt about him as a man, but it was a time for it to come to an end. There's no doubt about that. And it's an interesting one, that does a manager lose the dressing room? Yes. He's always lost part of the dressing room because of the players who he's not picking. But I think it's when that belief goes, really. But for me, again, I think I was different to other players because I never played for the manager, ever. I always played for the club. And again, because it was the club, I always felt like I played for the club and the supporters. And I'm not saying that to curry favour with the supporters as such, but no manager bought me. You know, I didn't know a manager or anything as such. I mean, Roy Evans gave me debut, I suppose, and other managers played me, but I never had that sort of feeling that we need to win this for the manager.
Rafa Benitez comes in next. Mm. What's the difference between Gerard Houllier and Rafa Benitez in terms of style? Because I find it so compelling that managers can be great for various different reasons. And we think of management as like a formula. But as I sit here with football players that have had 7, 8, 9 managers, they all say that managers are completely different in their style and approach.
Yeah, Rafa was completely different. Gerard Houllier was a manager. I think Gerard Houllier was the type of guy who could manage an organisation, didn't just have to be football. I think he could have been a bank manager. He could have been a CEO, if you like. He organised people, get everyone focused on, you know, what do we want to achieve? But the actual day-to-day stuff of coaching, I don't think wasn't his forte. And it might sound strange. I don't think he had a huge knowledge of the game, enough, but it wasn't someone who was going to say something to you in a coaching session or a tactical point that made you think, oh, never heard that before, or that's a bit different. It wasn't like that. His thing was bringing people together for a common goal, and almost when I've described him to other people, people say Clive Woodward, the England rugby coach, World Cup winning coach, was probably similar in that. Now he's had other coaches, but he's always been coming up with ideas to create sort of a siege mentality, a togetherness. Whereas Rafa was a coach, he was on that training pitch every day. And he was a lot colder than Gerard Houllier. He was a lot more interested in the kids, the wife, you know, yourself. You know, he'd ask me about my dad or different things like that. It was Gerard who, Rafa didn't want to get involved in anything like that. For him, it was just football. I mean, if I think I was obsessed with football. Rafa was just like, he was probably above me. So, but it was different, but it doesn't, I mean, I'll be honest with you. When we describe managers, like the one who came a couple after was Roy Hodgson, and it didn't go particularly well. But my point is, when a new manager comes in, I want to get whatever I can from him. So he may not work for Liverpool. I may not like X, but I might like Y and Z. Mm-hmm. So you're always got to be a sponge and taking things in and learning things. And I think when Gerard Houllier came in, I was a bit part player and then became a fully fledged member of Liverpool's first 11 for the next 5 years. And then Rafa came in and then again stepped up a level to become the vice captain and one of the leaders in the team, one of the best players in the team. So I always think I got the most from these other managers coming in, you know, who certainly Gerard Houllier, I don't think would have ever heard of me. Maybe, you know, not too much. But I think it's important when people come into your life, figures of authority, you've got to basically squeeze everything out of them to your advantage. And I think I did that with both managers.
Let's do the biggest pro and con then. So from what I of these individuals as managers, so Gerard Houllier, you said he's a great sort of man-manager, CEO type. That's probably, from what I hear, one of his greatest strengths. His downside is maybe a lack of football knowledge. Is that what you're...
I wouldn't say it was a downside because he had coaches around him who did the training sessions. It just, it got to its natural end.
Right.
In that, you know, you shouldn't forget, I mean, he nearly lost his life managing Liverpool. And he's then making decisions. Is he in a fully, you know, football-focused state of mind when he's actually recovering from almost losing his life? And we made a few signings that didn't work. And to be honest, that's always our ends for Liverpool managers when it comes to the end, that they have a summer where they buy a few players, they don't quite work out. And then the next manager has to come in because, you know, the energy and the excitement, not just from the squad, but also the support, is just petering out.
So Rafa's great tactically, obsessed with football, obsessed with the game, but his sort of downside was, everyone has a fucking downside. I have a downside as a manager and a CEO.
Yeah, yeah.
Is probably the man management stuff.
Yeah, but I don't think that stops us winning as such.
Yeah, it's just a different approach.
You know, nobody is everything.
Yeah.
Alex Ferguson is not a coach. He's probably more like a Gerard Houllier type figure and has coaches there. Rafa Benitez, people will question his man management, but I don't question it as such, and I don't question Gerard Houllier or other managers. You've just got to do what's your strength. That's your strength. So what if Rafa Benitez's strength is not the man management, I'm putting this act on. It's all about being obsessed with football and coaching every single day. Do what you're good at.
That's what I find interesting is there's so many ways to win. Because when I 100%. Sat here with all the United players, Rio, Patrice, Gary, they all say about Sir Alex Ferguson, they go, man manager, but only came in the training room dressing ground twice in 26 years or whatever. And then you hear about these other people like Rafa, who also tremendously successful, won the biggest trophies you could possibly win, but wasn't that way inclined.
History is written by the winner. It doesn't matter what you do. So if Sir Alex Ferguson doesn't do well at Man United, those same players will be saying to you, he's never at the training ground.
Yeah,
he's never there.
Yeah,
we don't do tactical work. He doesn't do any coaching. It's all about winning. And to be honest, what you're saying there is interesting because one time, I remember Rafa Benitez, he knew someone at United and he said, Ferguson doesn't even coach. Because in Rafa's mind, you've got to be, to be a top man, you're a coach. You know, I think when him and Mourinho came along, they were like coaches. And probably couldn't get their head around the way Alex Ferguson was. And it was almost a little bit dismissive. And it wasn't like I was trying to defend the Manchester United manager. It was just that training. Even Ferguson doesn't even do the coaching. I said, so what?
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't matter. He wins. There's different ways of winning. And that's my thing on TV now. There's no right or wrong way to play football. It's being the best you can be at what you do. And if that for Rafa Benitez is being on that training ground, coaching, not getting involved in stuff away from the pitch, well, that's someone else's job. You know, no one is perfect at anything. Alex Ferguson wasn't a great coach, so he brought in great coaches. I think that's really important, not just in football management. I actually think in life, in that, for me, I'm a little bit wary of getting involved in things where I think that's not my area of expertise. I think that'd be a little bit arrogant of myself to think I could just parachute myself in there and, you know, start running the show or get right involved in it. So I think we all got to know where our strengths are and all got to know where we need help because we all need help.
That's what Richard Branson taught me. You know, reading through his story, but also getting to speak to him on this podcast. This is a guy who didn't know what the difference between net profit and gross profit until I think he was 50, which is one of the key principles, like understandings of running a business. Dyslexic, can't look at presentations. If you try and show him words on a slide deck, he won't look at it. He'll only look at pictures. He's got so many deficiencies in areas that you think are critical to business. But the one thing that everyone says, he says, and everyone around him says, was because of all of his deficiencies, he made up for it by being the best delegator in the world. So he found people that could plug all of these gaps and gave them huge responsibility. And you think, you know, by the age of, at the same time when he doesn't know the difference between net profit and gross profit, he's running 50 different companies. Virgin is now 400 different companies. And you go, how is someone who is, in his own words, like not good at business doing that? Well, just a supreme delegator. And Sir Alex Ferguson, the same, bad coach, but had, can't remember his name, that guy that did it.
Carlos Queiroz, Steve McClain, had lots of different ones, didn't he? But yeah. I think what you're saying is really good, because the career I've had has afforded me so many opportunities. I'm so fortunate that I'm speaking to you. Mm. You know, you're speaking to other people who are experts in their field. But when you speak to them, and that story about Richard Branson, it is perfect in that if you don't know them, and, you know, say my family and friends, sometimes they're fascinated by some of the people I meet. And I said, I'm lucky to be in certain situations. And they look at these people like they're extraordinary. Mm. And when you've got a sort of relationship with someone, whether it's someone I work on TV with, they're just normal people. And they've got the same sort of insecurities that you've got. Mm. But they've got something about them where they've got sort of, maybe it's an opportunity that's arisen, they've grabbed it with both hands, they've an enthusiasm, something about them has put them in that position. But they're not extraordinary people. They've got an extraordinary talent for that, mm. You know, which finds themselves, I feel it, in that field. So that thing where some people are so impressed with someone or think they're going to give them these words that they've never heard of before, mm. I think the older I get now, I realise that a lot of people in, you know, great positions, it's not because they're some genius. Mm. Sometimes, as I said, it's opportunity. They've seen a niche in the market, whatever it may be. They've just gone out there and grabbed it.
You know, there's a real trap I've noticed based on exactly what you've said, where someone's successful. So what we do is we assume that they get everything right. And so with Richard Branson, because he's a super successful entrepreneur, we assume that he's the best at marketing, branding, finance, all of these things. And I noticed this a lot when I was in San Francisco, and it was when Snapchat, the app, had blown up, and we were building a chat app. And what you'd see the team doing was whenever we were trying to make a decision, the team were going, well, what does Snapchat do? Because Snapchat was successful, we assumed that their marketing strategy, every feature they had, everything they did with the login form, we assumed everything they did was right. And I came to sort of see that bias in myself. And it's exactly what you've described. If we see someone who is at the top of the game, we assume that they are godlike in everything. And that's what you do with Richard Branson. You assume he's the best speaker in the world. You assume he's the best salesman. No, in reality, from what I've learned from doing this, and honestly, looking at my own life, because I'm not actually good at business. Like, I'm not good at the business stuff. I'm not good at, like, finance, operations, processes, but I'm good at this one thing. And that's what I learned from Richard, is Richard's good at this one thing. He's like good, I'd say he's good at the branding piece, but he's just an unbelievable delegator. Mm. So that's, yeah, I mean, that's what I got from all of that. But it's funny having this conversation in the wake of Richard Branson, because he's the best example of that. One of the defining moments, I think in football generally, not just as a Liverpool player or a Liverpool fan, was that final away at Istanbul. You go in at half time, I think it's 2005 final, you go in 3-0 down. When you go down that tunnel at 3-0 down, honestly, do you think you can turn that game around?
No. Not at all, no.
What are you thinking when you walk through the tunnel then?
It's going to be 6-0.
Is that what you're thinking?
Mm. Oh, how can we stop it being 6-0? I think if you lose a game 3-0, it happens. If you lose 5 or 6-0, it's remembered. And that was my fear. That was fear.
What happened in the dressing room? What did Rafa say?
Not a lot. He wasn't a motivator. He was a tactician. And he made changes in there system-wise, strategically, to change it. But if I'm being honest, I think the changes he made was not to win the game. I think the changes he made was to stop it becoming 5 or 6 nil. Because we actually brought on a defensive midfield player, Didier Mann. We went to, you can call it 3 at the back, but it can be 5 at the back if you like, rather than playing 4. Don't get me wrong, the changes helped us go on and get the goals, but I think initially we need to stop what AC Milan are doing, otherwise this is going to be a massacre.
Why did the game turn around?
I think the changes Rafa made, a little bit of luck, and Steven Gerrard.
Mm. He scores the header, 54 minutes or something, and then within a couple more minutes, you're 3-0, you're 3-3.
That's the little bit of luck you need. You score so quickly right after. That happens in some games. And we did get a little bit of luck. I think the linesman actually flagged for an offside. The referee didn't see it, and they carried on playing for 30 seconds, so the linesman puts his flag down. And that's in the run-up to us getting our second goal. So we scored the second goal, and then, the only way you can describe it, it's just, you know when you're on a football pitch, you smell it, it's 3-2. I knew it was going to be 3-3. Everybody knew it was going to be 3-3. You just...
What is that?
I don't know. You just... The reason I know is because when we score 3-2, no one celebrates with the goal scorer. Everyone just runs back.
He started celebrating, didn't he?
He started celebrating, but it's...
Going crazy. I remember thinking you shouldn't do that.
Yeah, but everyone's back. It's like everyone's in a zone. And you don't need to speak to other people. Sometimes there's moments in games where you can smell it, you can feel it, something's happening.
Is that a culture thing as well? Because there's certain clubs who have that. When they go 2-0 down, 3-0 down, everyone goes, they're going to do it, they're going to come back. And there's that mentality where you go, yeah, we're not safe here, they're coming for us.
I think Liverpool and Man United have got it.
City seem to have it now.
City, yeah. Certainly in the last couple of years under Pep Guardiola. I've always felt Chelsea have had that in the last 10 years or so. Even when they weren't at the best, they'd still find a way to win. And yeah, I know our club's got that and will always have that. You feel like something's going to happen.
Why has Liverpool done so well in the Champions League?
I think a lot of that is emotion. Belief.
Winning those finals as well.
Yeah, winning finals, the history that's gone before, the Anfield crowd believe it, the opposition coming to Anfield believe that something's going to happen special. This is a mythical football ground.
Do you believe they're the best fans in the Premier League?
I wouldn't say that. And the reason I wouldn't say that is because everybody thinks they're the best fans.
Yeah.
And I think if I do say that, I won't be turning on my Twitter notifications in a few days after this podcast comes out. I would say yes. But every set of supporters, what they do to follow their team home and away. I think Anfield's special. I don't think anyone could deny that there's something special at Anfield that doesn't happen at any other places, where I think when we say that, you know, the crowd sucked the goal in, well, the opposition manager would always say before the game, no spectators ever scored a goal. That's pretty obvious. But at Anfield, it almost feels like, I think even top managers, even Pep Guardiola, his record at Anfield, maybe the greatest manager of all time, he's had some of the greatest teams of all time. His record at Anfield's horrendous. And he hasn't changed as a manager when he goes to Anfield. It's just like the environment, the atmosphere, mad things happen at Anfield.
Was that the pinnacle of your career, that final game at Istanbul?
I have to be honest, I couldn't believe I was playing at that level.
What do you mean?
Well, I was a huge football fan, probably the biggest football fan in the dressing room, who was just obsessed with football, read, watched everything. And I know about all the great teams, you know, going back to the Real Madrid teams of the 50s, Di Stefano and Puskas. Then you probably got the Bayern Munich teams of Beckenbauer, Cruyff teams just before that. Total Football Holland. Then you've got the AC Milan team, the great teams who dominate European football. AC Milan, late 80s, early 90s. I could name all the players, what they did. Guardiola's team of Barcelona. Obviously, that was after we were involved in the Champions League. And I'm very honest about my capabilities as a footballer, but I didn't think I was that level. Some people may still think I'm not. That's obviously football's opinions, but I always remember when we won the semi-final against Chelsea. I wasn't thinking, right, we're going to win the Champions League. My first few days afterwards was, I'm playing in a Champions League final. You know, this is like Maldini, Baresi, Cruyff, you know, all these players who I absolutely idolise and know so much about, they're defined by the European Cup or a tournament. I always think the greatest players of all time, they've either dominated the European Cup or they've won the World Cup or the Euros or something. It's, winning leagues is not enough. You've, to be really put yourself on a level of the real greats, that's what they all do. And it was almost, wow, I can't believe I'm playing at this level.
You know, that made me think about Ronaldo. Obviously, he's out of the World Cup now, and you've had a couple of strong opinions on Ronaldo over the last couple of weeks. So have I, to be honest, following the interview he did. And then I'm a Man United fan, so I didn't take it especially well, what he said and how he did it. And I thought it was very self-serving, a little selfish, etc. There's probably another way to do it. And I wonder now, I actually wonder if he regrets doing it. I wonder if he knew it would play out like it did, and then he'd go to the World Cup, be benched again, which almost kind of validates Erik ten Hag's position. Mm-hmm. But what's your whole stance on the Ronaldo saga?
I actually only watched the full interview a couple of days ago. He did with Piers Morgan. I'd only seen clips of it. And I watched the full interview. I'm not sure he's a guy who regrets anything or too much, if I'm being totally honest. Or certainly doesn't give off that, maybe in his private thoughts. I think the Portuguese one will have hurt him. But, you know, he's fallible. You know, he's not superhuman. He's one of the greatest players of all time. He's special. But I mean, I'm no huge Ronaldo fan. I think that's pretty obvious. And that's not for his footballing ability. I've got so much admiration for him for his mental strength. I just think it's unbelievable. I think probably one of the strongest players mentally, because he's had that thing his whole career. For how good he is, he still had sort of Messi on his shoulder. It's always, he could never almost sit back and go, I'm the best, and almost relax. He's always had this constant, yeah, but you're not as good as Messi. And I know people, it splits people, but I would say the majority of people would probably side with Messi. I would imagine, I think that they do. And I think to always have that, and always have that thing of trying to prove people wrong, and I've got that on a completely different level. It's almost like he feels like he's not rated, even though everyone says he's one of the best players of all time. And I can't help but admire that drive, because I've got that drive, but just not that ability that he's got. But I'm saying I don't want him to sort of ruin his legacy with interviews. I mean, I don't really care. It's not my problem. But it's sad for him, the way people are speaking about Messi towards the end of his career and Ronaldo, and it's completely different. And it's not to do with what's going on the pitch. I think it's always that idea that Ronaldo was about himself. It was his ego, whereas Messi has painted this like saint figure, when I don't actually think that's true. But people are talking about, want Messi to win the World Cup. You know, with Ronaldo, it's like, he's not the same player. But who is the same player at 37? So he's getting criticised for not being the same player at 37, 38, when really, he was getting lauded at that stage of his career. But because of the way he comes across, he storms off the pitch, storms down the tunnel, he's given that interview. People are obviously gunning for him now. And
where does he go from here? Because if he had a phenomenal World Cup, then there'd probably be a lot of doors open for him. Some top sides would probably want him, even just for a year contract or something. But in the wake of being a disruptive employee at his last role, and then going off to the Euros and being either a disruptive employee or just a poor performing employee, it makes you wonder, like, what manager's going to want to take on that ego, but also without the upside you get with just like incredible on-field performance? So it's now just, it seems like it's just
ego.
It's
tilted the other way now, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, Ronaldo hasn't changed.
Yeah.
He's always been that sort of character. Everyone's known that, but he was worth the hassle.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, and that's like everything in football. You know, when we talk about a manager making a decision, can you put up with that? And it's in your business, isn't it? In your life, you know, you don't cut off your nose despite your face. Mm. But when it gets to that stage where you're thinking, this is becoming more of a problem. And again, I say that to my son, you know, when a manager looks at you as a player, every manager wants the same thing. High performance, low maintenance. That's it. You know, certain players, you know, and it's when it goes, starts getting weighted to the high maintenance, is basically the scales are more tilted towards the high maintenance. It's time to go.
Did you see any high maintenance players in your career that were specific, particularly troublesome?
That were or weren't?
Were.
It's funny at Liverpool, in that I think Liverpool's a unique club, and I'm sure it's still the same. Liverpool supporters have an obsession with the manager that I don't think I've seen at any other club. So when the team win, it's about Shankly, Paisley. Now it's Klopp. We know there's great players. But the adulation, I think, started with Bill Shankly. And when Liverpool win, it's about the manager and the players. It's not the players and the manager. So the managers at Liverpool, I think, have always had a great deal of authority. They've always had the people with them. So it's never a case of a players could get a manager out. And I never saw that at Liverpool. Certainly not when I was there. Roy Hodgson had a tough time at Liverpool. He wasn't the right manager for the club. And the club moved him on after about 6 months.
Why wasn't he the right manager?
He didn't get the club. He didn't say the right things in the press. He was too defensive for Liverpool, for the top, not just for Liverpool, but for any top club. But listen, he'd had success in his career playing that way. And he wasn't going to change when he was in his 60s. So it was just the wrong appointment. It didn't work.
I read that Gerrard deliberately missed a penalty.
No, that is not true.
Yeah, I wonder. I couldn't believe it was true, but I read I thought there's no fucking way that Gerrard would miss a penalty. And I actually went upstairs before you came and watched it to see Gerrard's body language, and Gerrard did look pissed off when he missed it. But
nothing like that. And I mean, I felt sorry for him, to be honest. But my point of making about the club is, I think it would always be difficult at any stage for a player to have this big ego to sort of try and think he was more powerful than manager, because I think that's why managers love being manager of Liverpool, is because they'd always get time. You look at Jurgen Klopp now, and there was a spell in the season, the pandemic season, where he's done amazing. He's a godlike figure. But Liverpool actually lost 6 games at home against teams near the bottom of the table in a row. And I'm not saying he should have been sacked. What I'm saying is, at other clubs, that question would have been asked. I don't think there'd be one Liverpool supporter, a sane one, who would have actually even contemplated that for anything, because that's the type of support that they've been brought up on. The manager knows what he's doing.
Well, one of my best friends is, maybe my best friend in the world is a Liverpool fan. And I said to him this year when Liverpool was struggling, I said, what would it take for you to become Klopp out? He wouldn't answer the question. I pressed him for weeks and weeks and weeks. Eventually, I was like, if Liverpool get relegated, are you still Klopp in? He was like, yeah. And he just like leaves the group chat. But it's like a religious phenomenon.
Yeah, I don't, even with Ferguson at Man U, I know he was unbelievable, but I just think when I go to sort of see Man United's past, a big rival, it would be George Best and Bobby Charlton in that. And then maybe, you know, Matt Busby comes after them in some ways. Maybe I'm wrong, but it just feels like different at Liverpool. And I think that gives managers huge power, and why I don't think I've ever encountered what I would call player power as such at Liverpool.
Probably why Liverpool have been successful, though, because many other clubs have struggled with that. Even Manchester United, most recently, with some of the big personalities we've had, where the manager doesn't have authority. And you get into the first season and you go, the manager's going to be fired because we're not going to get rid of this world-class player. And then I was speaking to Jesse Lingard about this, like, because you can almost feel it in the air when it's coming, you know, you can feel that they've lost that phrase, lost the dressing room. I've always wondered if that was true. Can I ask, is it a real thing?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I probably felt that when Roy Hodgson was there. I don't think many players were enjoying the training or having him. And I was almost felt like I was trying to like, come on, you know.
Is there private comments, though, between you and Gerrard where you go,
Oh, yeah, of course. Listen, we're like fans. That would be maybe, what's he doing there? Why has he done that? I always remember, and the only time I've ever did this in my whole career, we lost a home to Blackpool under Roy Hodgson. And I think it was an international break, and I'd stopped playing for England then. And I couldn't sleep. And I went in the next morning, and I went straight into his office. And he was actually having a coach's meeting. And I was probably 33, 34. So I was a really experienced pro. And we just had this big discussion with all the coaches. And it wasn't, and probably said things to him that, he was talking about what he wanted to do for that. And I was saying, you can't do that. You can't do that. It wasn't me questioning him as a manager. It was almost like I wanted to help him. And not because he needed help as a manager. He needed help as a Liverpool manager as such. And it was almost like, no, if you come out and say that, or if you play this play, everyone's just going to, you can't do that anymore. That's got to stop. I wouldn't name the names I was talking about. I wouldn't do that. But that wasn't a case of me saying, you don't know what you're doing, you need to do it. It wasn't in an arrogant way. It was in a way as if, like, again, the club is just like, oh, where are we going? What are we doing? It wasn't for sort of, it was more trying to help the situation, really trying to help him as a manager, because I knew it was tough.
Sounds like he's lost the dressing room at that point. If
Yeah. I said that. You know, a lot of the players, what I'm saying is, he hadn't lost me as such. As I said, no manager could lose me or get me in some ways. And that I always felt like I wasn't really playing for them. I mean, I was behind every manager and wanted to take things from every manager.
We hear these stories where they're like, the CEO has had a conversation with a player.
That's a disgrace.
Is that true? Have you ever heard of that happening where the CEO of the club will have a conversation with the player about the manager? Is the manager right? Do we need to move him on? What's going on in the dressing room? Because if I was the CEO of a club and I'm seeing on the pitch that the club is performing badly, I might go and pull Stevie aside or you aside and go, how's everything going?
That happened once to me and I just absolutely completely said, this is an absolute joke. That happened in 2007 with American owners, Hicks and Gillette.
Oh gosh, that was a...
Yeah. Period. They'd had a big fallout with Rafa Benitez over transfer tax, whatever it must have been. And they wanted to sack Rafa and bring Jurgen Klinsmann in. And they... Me and Steve had the same agent. And rather, it wasn't a case of we'd speak to them on the phone. I never really never spoke to them, no need to. But they said, would Stevie and Cara be okay if Rafa Benitez was changed and we brought Jurgen Klinsmann in? And I was like, what? We'd been in a Champions League final about 2 months before. So we'd been in, under Rafa Benitez, we'd been in two Champions League finals in 3 years. But listen, I'm not defending the Americans in any way, but I know Rafa Benitez as a manager is hard work for a CEO and an owner. I know that. He pushes them to the absolute limit where I think in the end you think, oh, he's, you know, the performance, high maintenance type of thing. He's like that as a manager. But it was like, what? Absolutely not. I mean, why are you even speaking? No. I couldn't believe the question was even asked. Number one, because of how well we'd done as a team. But also number two, why are you asking me? It's just like, no. Don't ever almost put me in that position or situation.
Well, you can fire the manager.
Yeah. But if that did happen at that time, you can imagine it happened at other clubs, certainly Chelsea, who were just a revolving door.
And Rafa was eventually fined by them, wasn't he? I believe.
Yeah, but like 3 years later or something like that. That was when it was at its best with Rafa. Right. It wasn't a footballing decision. That was a personal decision.
So I'm guessing you didn't go and tell Rafa that conversation had happened?
No.
Okay.
No.
Eventually you retire, and interestingly, which kind of bucks the trend again, you said you were happy that your career was done.
Mm.
Why?
The roller coaster of emotions. It was, I'd had enough of it. You know, the highs and lows. And the high was never as high as the low was low, if you like. So no, I was done. It's very difficult to leave Liverpool. I'd seen other players leave because in Liverpool fans' eyes, and rightly so, where's better than Liverpool? I actually said that in an interview once, who's bigger than Liverpool? But we'd had players who'd left and gone to Real Madrid and Barcelona, but as a local player, you could never move to another English club or simply feel like you were going on the up. Your career might be petering out and you go lower down. Liverpool fans would be fine with that. But a local player moving, very difficult. You look at the reaction to Michael Owen moving to Real Madrid and then subsequently ends up at Manchester United. Even Steve McManaman is not loved as much as he should be for how good a player he was at Liverpool, I feel, because he left on a Bosman and went to Real Madrid. Didn't go to a big rival, he went to the biggest club in the world. That was always in my head. Not that I could necessarily move to a European giant, but the thing of how do you get out? How do I time this right? I don't want to carry on playing when I'm embarrassing myself and embarrassing the club or the supporters. So I've almost got to time this right. And I know towards the end of my career, there was Liverpool fans really questioning why I got a new contract at a certain stage. You know, why I was playing in certain games ahead of another player. Not massively, not where people outside of Liverpool would know, but again, you smell it, you feel it, the local paper, fans, you know, it just, you know, you're not stupid. And I had that at the start of my career. The flip side of that where it was always that thing of, am I fully rated? Am I good enough to play for Liverpool? So I always had that through my career. And I think the one thing that's helped me in my career is I've always had the feeling that I'm not fully rated. Or I think I've been underestimated a little bit as a player and maybe in the role that I do now, where no one's expected what I've ended up doing. So it's almost, maybe that takes a little bit of pressure off, but I've always felt like I've got something to prove. They don't quite think I'm good enough. I wasn't Steven Gerrard, I wasn't Michael Owen, I wasn't Robbie Fowler. When I got into the team, I was a slow burner and I got better and better and better as the years went on through experience and maturity. But there was always that thing of, am I good enough?
Did that make you work harder than people around you?
Yeah. 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 100%. It always felt like, I have it now where I always feel like there's some battle to win or some like, you know, I never look back. I never sort of think I've done that. I always remember something Brendan Rodgers said to me. He'd just become Liverpool manager and he'd been promoted the year before with Swansea. And he told me about Alex Ferguson sending him a letter, as I think Alex Ferguson must maybe do too, every manager who gets promoted. And he's written him this letter, well done, congratulations. And he said to Brendan Rodgers something. He said, but remember, never lose your fear. And I remember Brendan Rodgers telling me, and it was like a light bulb moment. And I went, I've never lost mine. It was almost like, yeah. Now, I'm not trying to compare myself to Alex Ferguson, but what I'm saying is, when he said that, it was like a piece of advice to Brendan Rodgers, and I'm sure he said it to other managers and players. But it was like probably the biggest figure in English football at that time. And I didn't say nothing to Brendan Rodgers. I said, wow, that is so important to success. I think always having that fear without letting it sort of overtake you where you can't actually, you know, mentally you can't achieve what you want to do, but always have that thing where you think someone's going to take my place. Someone's looking to beat me. So who am I competing with? It, you know, always having that. And I've still got that today. I've always still got the fear that, who's the next pundit coming? You know, what angle are they going to come at? I'll think about what I'm going to say before I get to a game.
It's the opposite of complacency, right? That
yeah.
fear.
Yeah, and whether you can put that into people, I've never had complacency in my life. I don't think I ever will.
Do you think, yeah, that's a good point. Do you think you can teach that? Or is that just a... Yeah, because I don't even...
Do you ever feel... I mean, obviously, you're very successful. Do you ever feel like you've done enough?
Of course not.
I don't.
Yeah, of course not.
Do you think that is a treat with people, you know, you bring on the podcast as well? It's just, I mean, even when I'm speaking to you, a lot of time I'm speaking about poor games, I'm not speaking about great games. Yeah. And it's just that constant feeling as if I can do more, I should have done more.
But the thing I'm most curious about is, of course, I see that in all my guests. I mean, Eddie Hearn comes to mind. His book is called Relentless. And he's, you know, I remember him... asking him, like, what's the end game? And he's like, well, you know, one day we'll sell this company. I go, okay, so that day you sell the company, then you go to the beach and have the pina colada. Is that, and you could just see in his face the horror, the thought that even if he sold Matchroom Boxing, he would need to go and just carry on fighting for something. And we all have that. I think we have it hardwired into us as just generally as humans. And that's why we're here in these buildings and have the roads and the cars, that our ancestors put something in us where they said, you're going to struggle forward. But then I think some people have it to an even more obsessive degree. And it's usually people who've had some early experience where losing came at a real cost to their self-esteem or to someone around them that mattered, or their dad, or, you know, they just learned early that losing meant that they weren't enough, they weren't worthy. And that's kind of what I was trying to understand in you is, because that I see that particularly in your story, that like obsessive competitiveness, but I don't see it in everybody. So where did that, like, what was the cost of losing or not winning or not, you know?
Listen, I've said it before. I go back to me childhood football, that feeling of winning, losing,
You were playing since you were three or something, right?
Yeah, so. Playing really early. And I was thinking about, you know, I was thinking about what I'm going to say when I come on here. What am I going to say that's, you know, a bit different than, you know, you have lots of guests. And
even that's you trying to overthink. Like.
Yeah, just thinking, you know, what nice point would you like to make? I don't know what you're going to ask me. But I think that the role I'm in now, we talk about the, you know, I've read that book, Bounce. Have you read that book?
The table tennis.
Yeah, the 10,000 hours sort of mindset of, you know, that. And, you know, I was a footballer for, professional football for 17 years, but you don't realise when you're in it or before it that it's actually a small part of your life, really. And the job I'm in now, I'm probably going to be doing it a lot more than I'm actually a professional footballer. And I actually think my 10,000 hours of what I did as a kid is almost not just to be a footballer, it's actually to be a pundit, an analyst, whatever you want to call it. Because I don't think anybody, and when I talk, the reason I'm talking about this is because I'm talking about being competitive now as a pundit, talking on TV, making good points, analysing certain games, is that who's going to come next? Who's going to try and take my place? But I don't think many, if any, have had my education in football the way I have. I don't think anyone could have done more in football than what I did to prepare me to get to where I was when I finished.
What about Gary?
No.
Do you think Gary, do you see Gary?
No, what I mean by this is not in terms of like putting hard work, and I'm thinking, talking about, I was getting taken to football games from the age of 4 or 5, amateur football. I was in the back of the van with all the players. So listening to men talk football, straight when you come back, go back to the pub. Everyone went back to the pub. So we'd meet at the pub, 12:30 on a Saturday and a Sunday. My dad was the manager. We're all back at the van. I'm listening to these, I'm 5, 6, listening to men talk football. Back to the pub. I'm playing on the pool table. All the football results are coming in. But again, that constant talk of football.
Why didn't you become a manager? People would think you'd become, you're a leader.
Yeah. I actually think leaders are interesting in that. I think it's almost like a different type of leadership now. I think in the 70s, 80s, maybe 90s, we always classed a leader as me. You know, whether you had the captain's armband, you're screaming and shouting at the referee, your own players, you're urging people on, and that is leadership. But I don't think that person necessarily ends up always being the manager. I'm just thinking now of Mikel Arteta. I played against him. I don't think I heard him say a word on the pitch. And then you look at, say, someone like a Tony Adams. Well, why is he not Arsenal manager? You know, and he's Roy that Keane. Leadership. Roy Keane, well, he's had a little go at the management, well, more than a little go. But I think management now is set up for more of the studious types. Not that I don't think about the game, but I actually think I've made a great decision not to be a manager. Because I think when I was playing, I thought like a manager. And I think what managers put themselves through is probably what I put myself through as a player, where you really torture yourself and you get that emotionally involved. And I would back my football knowledge. I wouldn't be embarrassed if Jurgen Klopp or Pep Guardiola came on Monday Night Football and we were talking football, and I might disagree with something he said, he might disagree with, I wouldn't feel out of place. Mm-hmm. But would I make a good football manager? I don't think so. I spoke to Michael Owen once, and sometimes it's when someone else says something to you that really hits home. And I was interviewing him, but he said to me, "You're not a people person." And I was like, "What? Aren't I?" He went, "No, not really." He said, "You don't have a, you know, you don't suffer fool. You know, you're quite sharp with people at times." And it was only, I thought, well, yeah, you're probably right. And that wouldn't help you be a top football manager, because you've got to put up with things. And basically, you know, if a player came into me and said he was injured, my first thought was he's telling a lie. I'm like that with my kids if they say they're sick. You know, I can't get that feeling out of my head that, no, they're bluffing. You know, that type of, I'd always think I'd be questioning, you know, players.
Speaking of your kids, how did fatherhood change you? Because I heard you say it changed you and I didn't find the details. So how did it change you?
Well, I don't think it changed me when my wife was pregnant. I don't think I realised the enormity of having a kid. Or having me son, I should say. I wasn't there for the birth. Liverpool had a game in Europe on the Tuesday in the Champions League, and I was with my wife on the Sunday. She went in, but obviously I hadn't delivered the baby by the Monday and we were travelling and I had to go. What I say, I had to go, I didn't have to go. But it was always that, at the time, it was like, oh, she'll be okay. You know, my mum was there and I went and we were getting beat 3-0 after half an hour. I was like, oh. But my son was born the day before the game. We played the game in Europe. And I always remember we drew 3-3 and we went out to Champions League, which was a big blow. And I always remember Gerard Houllier after the game toasting me. And I always loved and admired him for that because I used to think, I can't believe he's done that because I think I'd feel like my stomach's being ripped out if we'd just gone out to Champions League as a manager in some ways. And it was, I didn't realise how big it was to have a child. I think,
do you regret that?
Yeah, I do. Not just for being there when James was born, more for being there, you know what my wife's going through. You know, it's not easy. You know, the birth of a child. So, yeah, I regret that. I would advise anyone in my situation to, you know, be there. But I think it is the common thing now. I think even when you see, you know, different example, but sort of Raheem Sterling at the World Cup goes home on the back of his house getting burgled. Whereas maybe years ago that'd be seen as if like, well,
yeah.
You're at the World Cup here, you're playing for England, you know, and I think there's a lot more probably empathy and understanding from football managers now to sort of, you know, family matters. But with me kids, it's like, I wouldn't say I was a kid person before I had kids, you know, with relatives or something, but I feel like I'm completely different now. So I've got nieces and nephews who, it's funny really, because mine and Nicola's kids they're older. So James is 20, Mia's 18, Mia lives in New York now. But we've got nieces and nephews and we're almost at times in the house on our own. It's like, should we go and see the kids? We see the kids, not even our kids. It's a bit like, we need a fix of kids for sort of an hour, you know, winding them up. Have you got a boyfriend? Have you got a girlfriend? You know, all this thing that you did when your kids were growing up, because we really miss it. And I think my wife would have wanted more kids, but I was, no, we've got two. We've got the boy and the girl.
Nicola, your childhood sweetheart, you married her in 2005, I believe?
Yeah.
You've forgotten.
No, the Champions League, yeah.
One of the quotes that struck me was this.
So did you speak to her?
No,
I knew it hadn't. Because you know why? What? Because she tells me everything.
Really?
She can't keep a secret. She would tell me everything.
I reckon I could have got it. We'll find out maybe in the future, part two. This quote here where it says, "This part of my life story is the one I find most difficult to tell. I could talk to you for hours expressing my fondness for certain players or football teams, but doing the same thing about the woman you love? Question mark.
Yeah, I do find that even with sort of my mum or dad, really, you know, saying you love them, and I do to my wife, of course I do, but there's definitely, when we have disagreements, my wife, I'm not saying too much. But you say, but when you're on the phone talking to Sky or you're doing your newspaper column, you can't shut up. You're just, you know, about football and ideas. Where's this? You know, I want that. And I'm just not, I do find it difficult. I'm just not that person to come out with those words. And I don't know what it is. I mean, I think my brothers are the same. We were, yeah, you know, we're not like an overly huggy, kissy family. I'm like that with my kids and I'm like that with my wife. But I wouldn't be classed as someone who overdoes it, no.
Would she class you as an affectionate person or a romantic person?
I wouldn't say romantic. I might say affectionate. Is that different?
Oh, I don't know. Affectionate, I think of like kissing and schmoozing. Romantic, I think of like gestures, you know, like the roses and stuff like that.
Oh, probably more, yeah. Yeah, I would do things like that, maybe, yeah, yeah.
And what about, as you look back on the role that your parents played in your life, what would you, I've got all of these wonderful photos here, which I printed off earlier on.
Oh, go on, show me, you have to show me.
I'll slide the photos for you and you tell me what the person means in your life then. What about that one?
Oh, that's my dad, yeah. Yeah, huge influence. Yeah, still a huge influence now. A larger than life character. I think he's passed that. I wouldn't well, listen, I know I'm a strong character. I know I'm a big character. And I think that comes from my dad. I think that personality and character he's passed on to me, I think is the reason why I've become the player I have. Because the reason I got there was not just ability. I don't think my ability is Champions League final level. But I think my personality and character is, and that's what dragged, you know, Jamie Carragher, the footballer, to a Champions League final, because I can, I'm mentally strong and tough, and you know, and you have ups and downs in your life and your career, but as I said, nothing gets in your way, nothing stopping you, no obstacles in the way, and I think a lot of that comes from my dad.
What about this one?
I don't know who that is. Where have you got that?
Let me see the picture.
Hang on, I'm trying to work out.
Wait, I think. Do you know what that is?
I'm thinking.
That's a photo I printed off before. That's a completely different person's mother.
Oh my God. Nicola think I'm carrying on or something. Anyway, this kid.
Okay, I got that. What about this one? What does this mean to you? I can hear them laughing upstairs.
Yeah. That's my life. Yeah, that's me, Nicola, and two kids in Ibiza. Yeah, I'm really proud of my family and what we all have. And listen, we said before, no one's amazing. No one's got, you know, has got all the answers. We have our ups and downs, like any family. Or you have words. At the moment, me is in New York. Now we're the same as any other family. Can't sleep. Is she okay? My wife's going to sleep probably 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning because of the time difference, making sure she's in, and you know, just that whole balance of life. She was only supposed to do 3 months. She then told us a week ago she wants to do a year, and we're excited to bring her home, but so proud of her to go to New York at 18, living on her own, you know. But it's tough, but again, so proud. And James, what he's doing, playing football. I mean, not easy. I know, being a son of a footballer, I get all that. But I always say again, don't use that as an excuse, because there's positives to that as well, you know. But no, really, really, you know, proud of them. And what I always say to them is, have a story. When you get to at my age, older, make sure you've got a story. So, you know, what have you done? Do amazing things. Me has gone to New York. I don't know where that's going to lead, but what a thing to tell your own kids. I lived in New York for a year. You know, and that's, I always drum that into the kids. You only hear once, do special things, amazing things. Just go and smash life, basically. Just go and do it.
Jamie, thank you. Thank you so much. We have a closing tradition on this podcast.
I know, and I haven't got a question.
No, it's okay. You can take your time on that part.
Okay.
The part, and also when I ask people this question, they usually take like 5 minutes to think about the answer, which is funny. But the question that's been left for you, obviously the person didn't know they were leaving it for you, is, interestingly, do uncomfortable situations bring the best or worst out of you?
I would say the best. I think whether that's on the pitch, off the pitch, family stuff, I think when you're in the moment, I think I can almost narrow it down and not get too hysterical or too, it's a bit like, okay, need to do that and that, and almost be a little bit calmer in that. And that comes maybe as well on the pitch when you've had a bad injury, or you feel like someone's going to take your place, or you feel like something's a bit like, almost, what is it, car compartmentalizes it? Yeah. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
Not always good with words. But no, just get that focus of like, that's what I need to do. And I think it's probably a strength of mine, of like not worrying about it. Right. I think I like doing that with the kids or my wife, if they come to me with a problem. And it's always easier someone else's problems, because you don't have as much the emotional attachment and think about a few other things, but it's a bit like, And that's what I love about being a dad. Helping your own kids with those problems, and I've been there before, and sort of giving that advice. The best thing about getting older, I think, is experience and being able to give that to someone. And I think a lot of the time, you know, it's funny with my son, in that I think when he's in a really good mood and he's happy and his life's going really well, I know he's out with his mates and he doesn't need, but I know sometimes if he's not feeling 100%, I can just feel it, I can smell it. And it'll come to me, and you know, you want to be there to help, you know, that sort of passing on something. So I think from an individual point of view, yes, but I also love the fact that I love helping people on that side of it, when, because we're all in uncomfortable situations at different times. And whenever life's going great, I'm always thinking something's around the corner.
Slightly terrifying because it's so true. Jamie, thank you so much. Thank you for having this conversation. I was so excited to talk to you because of the mentality you have and how that's resulted in such tremendous career success for Liverpool, but now also as a pundit. And I can see that kind of relentless fight in you and how that hasn't disappeared. And I find it so incredibly inspiring that mentality is at the very heart of your success, because I do believe to some degree that that is something that people can pick up. Like, talent is one thing, being 7 foot tall and becoming a basketball player, but knowing that there is this other thing, which is the values we hold in our mind and the behaviors that creates that we can all embody, which you perfectly embody. I mean, Peter Crouch really... I think I told you, after the reason I reached out to you was because of that conversation with Peter Crouch. And I just thought, God, like the way he talks about you, like you're on this other level of extreme, you know, winning mentality, is tremendously inspiring. But also there's a cost to that. And you've kind of detailed the cost. You went to, is it Billy, the psychologist you went to?
Bill Beswick, yeah.
Bill Beswick. And you kind of detailed the cost of
is
that.
Is this still on now?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought we'd finished.
No, I'm just wrapping up. Okay. Yeah. We'll keep that in as well. But yeah, that's exactly it. It's the cost of that mentality, which I think is also important to be clear on. So thank you for being so honest. Really appreciate it. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Intel are now one of our sponsors on this podcast, and I'm here to tell you about their vPro platform. Security and data protection are totally non-negotiable when it comes to the technology I use for my businesses. I'm constantly thinking about where we can upgrade our systems to protect against potential threats. So this is where Intel vPro has become our go-to. Intel vPro is built for businesses. It has a hardware-based multi-layer platform security features protecting from cyber attacks, threat detection, and also recovery systems, all in one platform. In an ever-challenging cyber landscape, if I can put measures in place that I believe will save me time and money, then I absolutely will. So head over to intel.co.uk/vpro to find out how it could work for your business.